listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Spent the weekend, the 4th of July weekend, down in rural West Virginia. And I got some stories to tell you about that. And Sam, if you're watching, give us a shout. I was down near Lewisburg, just FYI. I want to tell you about the lawsuit that actually might bring down Obamacare. This is fascinating. There's just actually there's a lot of stuff, you know, for a dead summer. There's a lot of stuff in the news. The deny Obama any sort of legacy, any sort of functional presidency campaign continues, even in the face of common sense. And on. But in the meantime, over in Murrieta, Georgia, California, the good folks of the city decided to show up and protest children fleeing violence in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, where literally death squads are running around killing people. This is the legacy of Ollie North's activities down in that region back during the Reagan administration. You know, propping up right-wing death squads, they're back. And in the same area. The same people or they're, you know, the next generation. And for some reason, you know, David Gregory had Jay Johnson, the head of Homeland Security, on this weekend. And he said, you know, isn't this Obama's fault? And Jay Johnson said, no, you've got death squads going on down there. I mean, you've got children fleeing. This is a humanitarian crisis. And they're not just fleeing to the United States, they're fleeing to Mexico, they're fleeing to Brazil, they're fleeing all over. And David Gregory acted like he didn't even hear it. So, anyhow, S.C. Sherman is on the line with us. He's a columnist with the DailySurge.com about politics and culture. His website, S.C. Sherman, S.C. as in the initials, Sherman, S-H-E-R-M-A-N.com, is about the novels he's written, including Leaving Southfields, which won the Best Christian Historical of 2007. And he's the author of a whole bunch of different books. SC, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Your most recent book is Mercy Shot. So do you really think we should be sending riot squads into, you know, to deal with people fleeing a humanitarian crisis?
Not necessarily, no. I think the riot squads were sent in against the people that were protesting more than against the children themselves.
Well, do you think we should be protesting children coming into this country fleeing death squads?
No, I don't know. There's a lot of argument that they have a terrible situation that they're in. You know, if I was living in a place that had death squads, I'm sure I'd be fleeing too with my children or the children, or you just get them out. From what I've learned and studied on these, you know, people coming across, I personally don't have any doubt that I would feel the same way. And they would come after it. I just have some differences on how we should run our country, but yeah, no, they're in a bad spot. Those places are getting more and more violent every day. It's just horrifying when you see what they're going through down there.
Yeah, and frankly, our State Department is, in my opinion, is not helping a great deal.
Yeah.
And we haven't been since the 80s. But my understanding was that over at your blog that you've been basically supportive of the Murrieta protesters and dismissive of the Obama administration. Why? How?
How and why? I would be dismissive of the... I just cannot understand why we can't all get behind controlling the border. I don't think we should turn away these children, but they can't just be flooding across the border freely. We're like the only country that's allows this to happen at all. I mean, you can't get across Canada's border like this if anyone wanted to, but...
Actually, you can easily get across Canada's border. I used to live in Vermont. We used to drive up and drive across the Canadian border all the time. I mean, there's all kinds of rural areas where there's no checkpoints whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, I've never seen anybody get across in Minnesota real easily. So
see, here's the thing. Spot. You know, in the United States, we had this border. We've had this border with Mexico since we fought the Mexican-American War, you know, since President Polk did in the 1840s. Over the loud objections of Abraham Lincoln. And that border has always been wide open. And we tried to, you know, and people would come north to during the picking season, principally to California, typically about 1 million people a year by the 1960s. And they would come north and they would pick. And then they would go back south because they wanted to go home. And so we tried to regulate this with the Bracero program in the 60s, where we issued basically kind of, you know, 6-month green cards to people. But the problem was that the employers were using their ability to throw people out of the Bracero program as a way to threaten these immigrants, saying, you know, I'll say that you're not a good employee and you'll lose your ability to be here, which is their ability to make a living for their family, you know, take money back and feed their family for literally a couple of years from one season. And so the Bracero program was ended in the 70s because it was just really so, you know, racist and dysfunctional. And Reagan did a fairly decent comprehensive immigration reform. The problem was that in 86, after Reagan did that, he explicitly stopped enforcing the laws against mostly white, mostly rich employers in the United States who had been hiring people who were not in this country legally. Prior to 1986, one of the best industries that you could get into in the United States for a U.S. citizen was meatpacking or construction, because meatpacking was paying $30 and $40 an hour in today's dollars because they were good union jobs. And construction was paying, you know, anywhere from $25 to $50 an hour in today's dollars because they were good union jobs. And now in both of those industries, they're filled with people who are illegal immigrants, you know, who are here without documentation. And the reason why is because the Reagan administration made this intentional effort. We're not going to, like Eisenhower had, literally, and like Kennedy did and Johnson did, we're not going to throw any more white rich employers in jail, period. And so what that did was it created this giant magnet. You know, hey, there's jobs up north, and the administration's not prosecuting, you know, the employers. And so 11 million people came up here for jobs. Why don't, you know, it seems to me that we have an illegal employer problem, not an illegal immigrant problem. And if we started throwing some rich white guys in jail for hiring people who are here illegally, that this problem would vanish really, really quickly.
Yeah, if they're hiring illegal immigrants, then they're part of the problem, definitely. But we definitely have a magnet problem, and it's, you know, the word out that the children are going to get amnesty is the word through all the countries. Mexico,
well, those countries.
They're,
I mean, Joe Biden went down there a couple of weeks ago, and they're actually, we are paying for television ads.
Yeah.
You know, where the local politicians are saying, you know, the Dream program is only for people who were in the United States before 2011. There is, which Jay Johnson said on Meet the Press this weekend, and there is no such thing. You know, if somebody's, you know, there's this organized crime group that's, you know, people smuggling that is promoting this, they're lying, and they're telling their people this. What else are we supposed to do?
Well,
I mean, if you build a 12-foot wall, you're just creating an industry for 13-foot fences.
Well, fences, drones, whatever it takes to lock this border, it has to be locked down. We don't know that it's just Central American guys that need a better life coming across. We have no.
That's the vast majority of the children. It's well over 80% of these children are from Central America. They've traveled all the way through Mexico, 1,000 miles.
I understand that, and it's, you know, why wouldn't they? And that's your point, and I would maybe agree with you on that point. But not knowing who's coming across our border is insane. There could be, you know, the 20%, we don't know who they are. They're a combination of...
I just don't see it as a big deal. I mean, you know, the guys who did 9/11 came in on tourist visas.
The guy who doesn't have pot in his backpack, what if he's got a nuclear weapon back there?
I mean, well, yeah, like I said, the guys who did 9/11 came in on tourist visas. People, you know, bad guys can get in this country really easily. All they have to do is get a tourist visa.
An open border. Especially with the open border, they can get in easily.
Well, but, you know, we've got an open border with Canada. No Canadians are trying to come here because they have a higher standard of living than we do.
Well, we can worry about the Canadians coming south after we secure the southern border. That's the one that's being overrun right now.
All right. See, S.C. Sherman, you can read us all about it over at S-H-E-R-M-A-N.com. Good talking to you, S.C.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for dropping by. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
SWAT teams are privatizing, so we can't find out what's going on. I got some amazing news for you here. We'll be back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Kiss Kid in Yucca Valley, California, watching us on Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Kiss, what's up? Or hey, Kid.
I hope you had a great Independence Day, Tom.
I did.
I sure did. I went out... swap meeting and yard sailing, and Well, it's not very scientific, but I talked to a lot of ladies about the Supreme Court decision, Hobby Lobby, and it's about 90% that they overstepped their bounds. But I want to address something real quick.
Did you see about this? What this judge had to say about that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, this is incredible. I've got to find the story here. Go ahead and say what you're going to say while I'm looking through my stack, because I've got it in my palm.
Okay, I'll rant a little. You know, it's a 50-50, this conception of a child, and I've seen it. If, I hate this word, unwanted, but if it's unanticipated or inconvenient.
Well, some children are literally unwanted. And, you know, I mean, we used to run our community for abused kids. We got those kids.
I know you did. The Hunter School, well, Outgrowth might be the Hunter School. And,
yeah, it is.
I commend you for that. But the man, he has got to, he's entered into a contract for 18 years to give as much support as required by law if he doesn't enter into the love and attention equation. And chances are the man will find his way into the gray economy to avoid paying for his responsibility. And if they don't pay child support, they might end up with a criminal record. And we've got to keep talking about this because it's no business of the government, let alone the Supreme Court, to interject their opinion into a woman's and her doctor and her lover.
This is a family issue. This is a woman's issue. I'm with you. Here's what this federal judge said. This is Judge Richard Kopf. He was appointed to the federal bench by George Herbert Walker Bush, and he has his own blog. And he said, the court is now causing more harm and division to our country than good by deciding hot-button cases that the court has the power to avoid. As the kids say, it's time for the court to STFU.
Wow, STF, that's shut the...
Yeah, beep up.
Yep.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Can I say one more thing, Tom?
Yes, sir.
Obamacare is only for profit private insurance companies with more protections for the consumers and expansion to broaden Medicaid.
Right.
A healthier society is more productive and medical costs go down.
Oh, I know. The opposition to this has nothing to – there is no rational basis for the opposition to this. The basis for the opposition to this is that the Republicans do not want Obama to have any kind of legacy. They don't want any chance that he'll become like Tommy Douglas in Canada. They don't want there to be any chance like he'll become like the way that they've reinvented Ronald Reagan in America. They want, you know, 20, 30 years from now, people to sit around and say, boy, that black guy really screwed up. That's what they want. And they are doing everything they can to make sure it happens. Kid, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. We will be back. States that have raised their minimum wages are growing fast. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff I got to share with you. We'll be back. In addition to David Gregory's disgraceful performance over the weekend with Jay Johnson, the director of Homeland Security, which I read the transcript of. I didn't actually see because Louise and I were down in West Virginia. And I want to talk about that at some length in the next hour. What I learned this weekend, but we had no internet, we had no TV, we had no phone, so because we were in a holler, you know, down in a valley where there were no cell towers around, and had a wonderful time. And there was a group of people doing a Native American sweat ceremony and a vision quest, a bunch of young people up in the mountains for 4 days. And well, as I said, I'll tell you about it in the second hour. But I mentioned the lawsuit that could end Obamacare. And it's interesting. The only place I've seen this reported, at least today, the only place it's easily found is over at Talking Points Memo. And Shahil Kapoor, who has been a guest on our TV program a number of times, I think he's been on our radio show as well, on this show. There is this new it's considered a long-shot lawsuit against Obamacare. And It is an appeal is before an appeals court right now, and then it'll make its way to the Supreme Court. And let me give you the summary of it. The summary of it is that the actual literal language in Obamacare says that the subsidies, you know, if you buy health insurance in Obamacare and you make less than about 80 grand a year, you actually get a discount on your insurance. And in fact, the average person, the average new person buying Obamacare right now is paying less than $100 a month in the United States. And it's because they're getting these federal subsidies. And they're getting these subsidies even in the red states that haven't expanded Medicaid. Still, working people who earn enough to qualify for Obamacare, not for the Medicaid, but for Obamacare, they're getting these subsidies. And because these states are not participating and they're not setting up their own exchanges, the states aren't picking up the tab and allowing the federal government to block grant it to them. The money is supposed to go from the federal government to the state to your insurance company. But in these states that refuse to cooperate, it's going from the federal government directly to the insurance company. Well, here's what the law reads. The law reads that the provisions of the premium tax credits will go to, quote, an exchange established by the state. And so the lawsuit says these states aren't establishing exchanges. Therefore, the federal government has no authority to give this money to these insurance companies that are operating in the states that have not established exchanges. And technically, they're right. You know, this law was written fairly hastily for something as big and expansive and long-term as it is. And, I mean, you know, so is Social Security. And the Social Security Act has been amended hundreds of times over the years. Maybe more than that. Maybe even thousands. I don't know. But certainly hundreds of times. On a bipartisan basis, in good faith, to make the bill better. But because the leadership of the Republican Party, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, this is all in the House, Kevin McCarthy, senators like Jim DeMint, Jim DeMint, Tom Coburn, Dr. No, John Kyle, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. Because these guys, you know, had the caucus room conspiracy meeting in January 20th of 2009, and they swore to each other, we're going to deny Obama a legacy. We're going to deny him a successful presidency. As Mitch McConnell said, my number one job is to make him a one-term president. So as Pete Sessions said, you know, we're going to become like the Taliban. As Kevin McCarthy, who's now the House Minority Leader, or Majority Leader, said, we are going to fight him on every bill. And as a consequence of that, Obamacare has all these little problems, and they should be fairly easily fixed. But the Republicans will not fix those problems because that would mean basically improving Obamacare. And they're committed to destroying Obamacare, not because they don't like the idea of Americans getting health care. I think a lot of these people are, you know, they're decent people deep down inside. They would, if they ever met the family of that young woman, I'm forgetting her name, who died because she fell into the Charlene Dill, who fell into the red state donut hole. And she knew she had a heart condition. She'd been to an ER. And she had to take a third job to pay the bill for the ER. And they told her, you need to take this medication or you're going to have a heart attack. And she couldn't afford the medication. And she didn't qualify for the Medicaid. She was in a state that in Florida where Rick Scott refused to expand Medicaid. And so she had no choice but to work a third job to try to just pay off the ER bill, and then maybe she could afford to pay for the medication, and she had a heart attack and died while she was working her third job. And she had a little kid. I think most of these Republican legislators, if they looked Charlene Dill in the well, they'd have to look her in the coffin now. But people like her, that they would have some compassion. But that's not going to get in the way of their absolute commitment to stop the first black president in the history of this country from having a successful presidency, or frankly, any Democrat. There's a large element of racism among the Southern politicians and even some of the North. And there's a large element of, you know, Republican rule here. And they know, the Republican Party knows they're losing. They're demographically losing. They're culturally losing. And so what are they doing? They're rigging the game. In fact, students now, using the 26th Amendment, are suing against these voter suppression laws. So anyway, I got a lot of other stuff to rant with you about. Also, you know, the immigration thing, if you've got some thoughts on that, give us a call. I'll be picking up your calls right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Immigration, Obamacare. I got to tell you about the states that raised their minimum wages. The students joining this battle to upend laws on voter suppression. It's amazing. Amazing stuff going on. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with us. Time for our Borowitz Report. After a report from the Yale Center on Climate Change Communication showed that the term climate change elicits relatively little concern from the American public, Andy Borowitz reports leading scientists are recommending replacing it with a new term. Quote, you will be burnt to a crisp and die, end quote. Other terms under consideration by the scientists include, quote, your cities will be ravaged by tsunamis and floods, end quote, and, quote, Earth will be a fiery hellhole incapable of supporting human life, end quote. Scientists were generally supportive of the suggestions, with many favoring the term, quote, your future will involve rowing a boat down a river of rotting corpses, end quote. Any of these terms would do a better job conveying the urgency of the problem. Tracy Klugian, a spokesman for the newly renamed Yale Center for Oh My God, Wake Up, You Fools, said, many thanks to Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com. And the word fools was a little more explicit, but you can't say it on the radio. But you get the idea. Anyhow, as I said, there's a lot going on. We got 3 hours to get into it all. We've covered a couple of topics here, and we will get to more, but wanted to get you guys in here, too. It is, after all, summer, so it's anything goes summer, as well as the topics I've been talking about. So feel free. Mike in Lomita, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. I'm just thinking about this Hobby Lobby case and the door that the court opened here.
Yeah.
It seems to me, if memory serves, that this Religious Freedom Restoration Act may have had something to do with Native American religions.
It was the response to the Supreme Court ruling in a peyote case in Oregon that, and I don't recall, did the court rule in favor of the peyote users or against them? I frankly don't remember. I think they ruled in favor of the peyote users, saying that, you know, they were using a fairly relaxed standard of, you know, proof that the peyote users had to demonstrate that, you know, it was in the good of the government and all these other things. And so what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act does is it complies with Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says Congress can regulate the Supreme Court. Congress can provide the exceptions under which the court can rule and can regulate the court. And so the act, which I am holding in my hand, says that the purpose of this act, the purposes of the act are, one, to restore the compelling interest test as set forth in Sherbert v. Verner and to guarantee its applicability in all cases where free exercise of religion is substantially burdened. In other words, you must demonstrate that if the Supreme Court must say, if they are going to say in a ruling anything about anything, that there is a compelling interest to the United States of America for this to happen, number one. And number two, to provide a claim or defense to persons whose religious exercise is substantially burdened by the government. So this compelling interest and substantial burden, these are the highest thresholds that the court can, you know, that people have to jump over to satisfy the court. And so the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 was designed to make it harder for the Supreme Court to just say to any old person, oh, yeah, your religious practice is just fine, or your religious practice is no good. In other words, it made it harder for the court to rule on religious practices. And okay, the court said this is one of the reasons why they limited this to contraception, rather than saying that this applies to, workplaces that where you may have, you know, Pastafarians who want everybody to wear a strainer on their head or whatever. Making sense?
Yeah, it makes...
And in fact, the court said in their ruling that they were constrained by, they explicitly said this in the ruling, in the Hobby Lobby ruling, that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act constrained them and essentially forced them to rule this way.
Yeah, that's what they're saying in this decision, but down the road, who knows?
Yeah, I agree.
What occurred to me, though, is that this has stirred something in memory about the old false face cults, and especially in the Iroquoian peoples back in the East Coast, where basically you put on a mask and you become a supernatural creature which has more than mere mortal powers.
Yes.
And basically that's what they seem to have done with the Hobby Lobby thing, because you have this legal fiction, which is not a person with a physical body.
Right, the corporation.
But it has you know, the capacity to not die. It cannot be drafted and sent to Vietnam.
Or Iraq.
Or Iraq. And now it seems that it can, while it's already a privileged status.
Yep.
They
can accumulate infinite amounts of money. It never has to go through probate. Up until the 1890s in the United States, every state said that a corporation can't last more than 40 years, more than basically the working lifespan of a person. But now corporations can live forever. They are superpersons. And now the Supreme Court has said not only that, they have religion. And
now,
this has opened a Pandora's box. You mark my words.
Under Hobby Lobby, though, this legal fiction has the, without a body, has the capacity to dictate to a real person with a body what
That's correct.
Contraception they can use.
Yeah, specifically women.
I think
if this decision had affected men, if Hobby Lobby had been refusing to pay for Viagra or for vasectomies, I don't think there's any way the court would have ever ruled this way.
Yeah, and if corporations could get pregnant, the contraception would be
it would be a sacrament.
Right.
Yeah.
So I suggest that we should all go back to one of these Iroquoian false face cults and incorporate ourselves and declare our exemption from any government imposition which disagrees with our religion.
This is already happening. I mean, there's more than 50 corporations right now that have lawsuits in federal courts, almost all of them going beyond Hobby Lobby, most of them having to do with contraception. This is happening on the right. I realize you're saying we should do it on the left with things that are you know, pushing our favorite things.
I'm saying we should do like entertainers, become corporations, and then assert our religious liberties.
Yes, I agree. But here's the thing. I mean, on, you know, the Supreme Court issued this ruling on, what was it, Thursday? Or Wednesday, rather? And, yeah, Monday, whatever it was. The day that they issued the ruling, the next day, they said to lower courts that were deciding cases that were saying, because they said four out of these 20 contraceptive methods Hobby Lobby didn't have to pay for. There were other corporations who were saying, we don't want to pay for any contraception method, period, even condoms. We don't want to pay for anything. And what the court said to the lower courts was, go ahead and decide these, basically, and give, you know, illegalize all 20 of them. And they said to the courts that had ruled before against the corporations, you have to reconsider your decisions. And this was, you know, considered a fine-tuning of the case. So, Mike, I got to move along, but thanks for the call. Happy summer. Brian in Mentor, Ohio. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to make a couple of comments on that caller you had on just a while ago, the S.C. Sherman guy.
Yeah.
He and folks like him are always complaining about, oh, these people are crossing the border in hordes and taking away our jobs and forcing us to speak their language. Well, isn't that kind of what we did a few hundred years ago to the Native Americans?
Yeah.
It kind of sucks when the shoe's on the other foot now, doesn't it?
It does. And having written a Christian novel that won some sort of Christian novel prize, I was tempted to ask the question, you know, who would Jesus exclude?
Exactly.
You know, yeah. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Cindy in Euclid, Ohio. Hey, Cindy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share with you something I found that it's a precedent that kind of flies in the face of the Hobby Lobby decision. It's Reynolds versus the United States in 1878 that was basically about polygamy. But listen to what the Chief Justice said on this matter. He said that laws are made for the government of actions, and while they cannot interfere with mere religious beliefs and opinions, they may with practices. Suppose one believed that human sacrifices, and he went on with a lot of other things, you know, a wife throwing herself on a funeral pyre and things like that. Basically, to permit this would be to make the professed doctrines of religious belief superior to the law of the land, and in effect to permit every citizen to become a law unto himself.
Wow.
Could exist only in name under such circumstances. And this was, let me see, Chief Justice Waite wrote this.
Oh, Morrison Remick Waite.
Right.
And what year was that?
1878.
And what was the case name?
It was Reynolds versus the United States, 98 U.S. 145 in 1878.
Okay, I'll have to look that up. So basically what they were saying was that while polygamy is a religiously held belief, and we're not going to tell you that you can't believe in polygamy, we are going to tell you that you can't engage in the practice of it, because practices can be regulated. See, this is the distinction we used to make about money. Up until 1976 in the United States, for the first 200 years of our history, we said spending money for political purposes is a behavior, and we can regulate behaviors. And then in 76, with Lewis Powell on the court, Lewis Powell said, no, spending money is a form of speech. It is protected under the speech protections, the free speech protections, in the First Amendment. And that set up basically Citizens United, and it set up the Koch brothers and Shelley Adelson and the modern oligarchy, the modern American oligarchy, where you had the Koch brothers just last week getting together a whole bunch of the richest people from around the world, not just people who make their money in America, and committing to, spending $500 million to make sure that the Senate flips Republican this year. And that's a mind-boggling, half $1 billion in a midterm election. It's mind-boggling. We now have an oligarchy in this country, and not to mention a constitutional monarchy. You got a constitutional monarchy over at the Supreme Court, which created the opportunity for the oligarchy. The oligarchs stepped in and said, okay, fine, we'll take it from here. And they are. And Jefferson and Madison and these guys, they have to be rolling. Hamilton, even though, Jefferson, Madison, and Hamilton all disagreed on things. John Adams, Jefferson and Adams hated each other for 20 years. They would all be rolling. They are all rolling in their graves. They have to be absolutely horrified by this. Thanks for the heads up on Reynolds versus U.S., Cindy. I'm going to have to look that one up. That sounds good. Thanks so much for the call and for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, this should be interesting. Donald thinks immigrants have no respect for our borders. Let's get to that in a few minutes. Yeah, good point. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Although a lot of those kids are just showing up saying, I'm here. But anyhow. Bill, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Raleigh, North Carolina. Bill, you wanted to correct me about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. What say you?
Hey, Tom. I'm a longtime fan. I love the show. I'm down here in Moral Monday country with Reverend Barber. I just heard, so the caller that you were just speaking with that said, it was talking about the case of the Native Americans, and I'm not an expert, but a lot of people were writing about this immediately following the recent Supreme
Right.
Court ruling, and I think it was exactly the other way around that and Scalia actually wrote that opinion against the Native Americans, and he ruled that they did not have the right to use peyote.
Right. Well, that's why I said I didn't remember exactly whether it was for or against them. So thank you for.
Essentially, it was a way of saying that the U.S. government has the right to regulate peyote as a controlled substance.
Right. And no matter what your religion thinks about it.
Yeah, so in that case, so it's another example of Scalia being completely inconsistent.
Right, so back in that case, what was that case? It was like Smith or something? It was
two or three, I think, men, Native American men, who had been charged with use of peyote, and they said, well, this is part of our religious...
Right. No, I remember that. I was just wondering what the name of the case was. I read it in the...
I don't have
it. Pardon? Yeah, it was... Say what? Employment Division v. Smith. Yeah, I knew that there was a common name in there. And so in that case, basically Scalia said, I don't care what your religion says. We, the government, can regulate this peyote stuff. And in this case, he said, your religion, we, the government, have said that women should have access to birth control through their insurance companies, but your religion is so important that we're going to blow up our own federal laws.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it just shows the height of fraud, just what a fraud I mean, he just applies. I mean, so the whole idea of law is that it has to be consistent, right?
Yeah.
And that's the whole theory of law.
Yeah.
And a guy like Scalia just blows that up because he just uses it however way, you know, to it's fitting the, you know, fitting the ruling to the desired end point that they want to get to, right?
And well, and the classic case of that was Citizens United, because Citizens United was a very narrow lawsuit initially. It was whether or not the within 90 or 60 days provision of the McCain-Feingold Act, which said it had two pieces, whether an ad for an anti-Hillary Clinton movie was political speech, number one, and number two, whether running that ad within that 90-day window that you can't run ads unless you identify them as ads, as political ads. In other words, they would have had to say this is a political ad. They would have listed it, you know, and all that kind of stuff within 90 days of a primary. And so they were challenging these two things. And Scalia and Roberts, basically, I guess it was Roberts, actually, but at Scalia's, you know, he was pushing for this thing, said to the Citizens United people after the initial pleadings and the initial amicus briefs were filed, went back and said, come back to us again, only this time argue on a much larger basis, saying that Citizens United is a corporation, as such it has free speech rights, and saying to us that, as such, we should strike down much larger parts of McCain-Feingold, which they did, they ultimately did. And that, you know, talking about legislating from the bench. Bill, thanks for the call. It's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Donald in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's about the immigration problem that we're having. You know, the thing is with me is I can understand the ones that are here, have been here for like 15 or 20 years, these kids that came over, and then they wanted their parents to come over, and they're going to be granted amnesty. That, you know, they've been here for a long time, and I can understand that. But I don't know. When is this going to stop, though? It's never going to be ending. It's a continuous stream that's going to be constantly being used in this manner to go ahead and bring the kids over here, and oh, they're going to be sent to their relatives. Really?
We have two issues here, Donald. We have the one, which is the issue of people coming here looking for work, which has been going on ever since 1986 when Reagan stopped prosecuting rich white people for hiring people who were undocumented. And basically said, you know, we're no longer going to enforce immigration law. We have that problem. And that led to roughly 11 million people coming here looking for work and getting work and wiping out the unionization. And the reason Reagan was so happy about this was because it destroyed unions. The Carpenters Union, my brother was a member of the Carpenters Union. It used to be one of the most powerful unions in America. The Meatpackers Union used to be huge. They started their own football team. It was called the Green Bay Packers. I mean, these used to be major forces in America, and Reagan destroyed them by simply saying, we're not going to enforce the laws that say that employers can actually go to jail and suffer large fines if they hire people who are not documented U.S. citizens. And so, you know, it was a twofer for Reagan. Number one, it drove down wages, and number two, it destroyed the unions. And the method that he used was allowing employers to hire people. So you've got that problem. And the easy solution to that problem, which even in the absence of any amnesty or immigration reform, if you were to say we're not going to do any immigration reform at all we're going to do is start prosecuting employers of people. You know, anytime we bust somebody working here illegally, we're going to send their employer to prison. If we start, and we have the legal authority to do that, it's in the law. If we started doing that tomorrow, within 6 months, probably 5 or 6 million people would head south. The problem you'd have at the border would be, how do you get people going south? I mean, how do you let them go south? Number one.
Yeah, but
and then the second problem that we have, which is the more immediate problem right now, is you've got three countries where back in the 80s, the Reagan administration was funneling money in via Ollie North, money that they made illegally selling weapons to Iran in exchange for the deal to keep the hostages during the Carter administration, and also to release some hostages that that Hezbollah was holding in Lebanon. These weapons that, in defiance of United States law, the Reagan administration committed a felony and sold weapons to Iran, and then took that money because Congress had passed a law saying that the Reagan administration could not use federally appropriated funds to give to the death squads in Central America. Can't do it. Can't support the Contras. So they took that money that they had gotten illegally in Iran off the books and laundered it and into Nicaragua to the Contras. And not just Nicaragua. Nicaragua and the Contras, the death squads in El Salvador, Guatemala, and these countries. And you know, it took down Daniel Ortega and flipped these countries. And now the chickens are coming home to roost. The death squads are back, the ones that have been funded by Reagan. Now they're being funded by right-wing billionaires and drug lords down in Central and South America. And in many cases, the drug lords and the right-wing billionaires are the same people. And the, in fact, the government of I believe it's Guatemala, is now like 70% of the government's estimated. All the senior officials all the way up to the president are like drug lords or tied into them. And they are right, and they run what, these right-wing death squads. And they're, you know, you are more likely to die right now in Guatemala than you are in Iraq. And Iraq is no paradise, right? I mean, we all have a sense of how dangerous Iraq is. Guatemala is more dangerous. And so people are sending their children out. And we need to be doing something about this. We need to stop. We're actually supporting these right-wing governments. We're sending them hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid. We need to stop. And the reason that we're giving them money is because we don't like the left-wing governments around them, like in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Chile, in Argentina, in Brazil, where you've got, you know, left-wing or center-left governments that have emerged and that are giving everybody free health care and are taxing the rich at very high levels. And the right-wing billionaires don't like this stuff, and they have incredible influence over U.S. foreign policy. And these are two completely separate issues, and we need to deal with both of them. Am I making sense, Donald?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yes, you're making sense, but the thing is why is it falling on our shoulders? Can Mexico do anything? I mean,
Mexico's got the same problem, Donald. We're getting 60,000 refugees a week, or whatever it is, a month. Mexico's getting 10 times that.
Oh boy!
Yeah, it's a disaster. This is a humanitarian disaster that we are standing by with our hands in our pockets, going got nothing to do with me, you know, yeah, because it all reflects back on St. Ronnie. You're not going to get this Congress, this Republican-owned House of Representatives, to appropriate any funds to help with what's going on down there, and they're not going to cut off the funds to the right-wing death squads and these right-wing corrupt governments down there. And tragically, the Obama administration, the State Department, has not taken a strong position on this, and they should be. This should be a big deal. Jay Johnson started to talk about this on Meet the Press this weekend, and I think, frankly, this is one of the reasons why the Obama administration is not doing anything about it. David Gregory says, "Hey, we got 60,000 people coming across the border, all these little kids, and you know it's going to get worse, isn't it?" And Jay Johnson, and this is because our border is too porous. And Jay Johnson said, no, it's not because our border is too porous. It's because there's a damn war going on down in Central America against its own people. And, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but you could read the transcript or watch it on TV. And David Gregory acted like he didn't even hear him. And I think it's because either he doesn't want to talk about it, or he's so stupid he doesn't know it. And the American people don't know it because the American press is not reporting on it. I mean, I see reporting about this on RT, I see it on Al Jazeera, I see it on BBC. I do not see it in the American media anywhere. I don't see it on CNN, MSNBC, Fox. Well, I don't watch that much media. I mean, maybe it's out there and I just don't see it. But I'm not, you know, I'm not reading it in the newspapers. I do read the New York Times every day. I read the Washington Post. I'm just not seeing it. And ever since 1986, I've seen no public discussion about the fact that Reagan stopped enforcing, you know, the immigration laws, the illegal employer laws. Donald, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
So I was down in, welcome back to the program, by the way. So I was down in West Virginia over the weekend. We flew down on Friday morning and came back Sunday night. And I did not see any fireworks. I was in a holler. And up on the mountainside, there were seven young people who were spending 4 days all alone in the woods, no food, no water, doing a vision quest. And down below in the holler, there were about 60 or 70 people who were doing sweat ceremonies morning and night and singing up to the people in the mountains and periodically going up and checking to make sure they were okay. And it was pretty cool. And we were staying with some dear friends of ours who live nearby and who were helping support this effort. And then we drove around West Virginia. I think I've been through West Virginia like years ago, but I had no real clear memory of it other than just, you know, a highway with lots of trees. I think I drove through North Carolina coming up from Atlanta once when we lived in Atlanta for like 13 years. But in any case, we also had an opportunity on Saturday afternoon, I think it was. We went into Lewisburg and we met with a bunch of local activists who were doing some really cool community stuff. And one of them is a lawyer who has, in fact, a book has been written about him. He's doing some really, really great work suing the coal companies. He's a friend of Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s and whatnot. And what I got, you know, number one, I mean, you know, the environmentalists there are like, you know, let's just stop the mining, keep the coal in the ground. I understand that. I'm with you. But to take it a step further, a step beyond that, I'm looking at Alaska. I mean, I'm driving around We were driving around in West Virginia, and you see these very wealthy areas where people have, you know, sold their land to the coal companies, or they're involved in the lumber business, which are basically, you know, the extractive industries are basically it. Or they came in from out of town with a lot of money and built a nice house. And then there's everybody else. And there's this, you know, there's kind of a middle class, but there's a lot of people just hanging on by their fingernails. An enormous amount of poverty in West Virginia. West Virginia has not raised their minimum wage. The poorest fifth of their income of their population over the last decade or two has gone down in wealth and income. And so I'm looking at this thinking, you know, Thomas Paine suggested back in the day, back in the 1890s, in a pamphlet or a booklet, which is still in print, called Agrarian Justice, Thomas Paine suggested that when a person is born in the United States, the government should put a certain amount of money into basically an annuity, a fund for them, which would gain interest over time. So that by the time they became 21, or adult age, I don't know what it was back in the 1870s or 1780s, 1790s. I mean, it might have been 16 or 18 or whatever. But by the time they reach that age of majority, they have available to them a regular income for the rest of their lives as a consequence of the, you know, this fund and the profit from it, the interest from it. So it's kind of a guaranteed minimum income for every American. Alaska does this. Sarah Palin has, I think, seven people in her family, if I'm correct, five kids and her husband and her. That's seven. And the average amount, back in the 70s, they created this thing called the Alaska Permanent Fund. They said, you know, okay, the oil companies are coming in. They're taking all this oil out of our state. We own some of this oil. And even the oil that we don't own, you know, the Alaskans figured this out early on. I mean, back in West Virginia, I mean, some of these coal claims go back to the 19th century, where, you know, the New York banks came in and said, we'll buy the minerals under your land. You can still be a farmer here. You'll never even know that we're here. No problem. You know, we're going to mine way deep underground underneath you. You know, and here's some money. Okay, fine. Here you go. And then pretty soon, you know, they're being pushed off their land. But the Alaskans said, we're going to take this money, we're going to put it into a giant pot called the Alaska Permanent Fund, which now has billions of dollars in it. And every year, we're going to take all the interest from the Alaska Permanent Fund and give it back to the people. So everybody in Alaska gets a minimum income of, you know, whatever the permanent fund pays out that year. And typically, it's around $2,000 a year. So Sarah Palin, when she was governor, was writing her own family a check for $14,000 a year and everybody else in Alaska. And so I'm looking at West Virginia thinking, why don't they do that here? The state could do this. You do it as a carbon tax. Real simple. Or a coal tax. You say, you know, from now on, we're going to charge X, you know, $10 a ton, $50 a ton, whatever. I don't know the economics of coal. Enough that it's consequential and it builds a large amount of money for the state, but not so much that it shuts down the coal industry. Now, I realize there are people who are saying, let's shut down the coal industry altogether, and I'm all in favor of that. And I think that as a 10 or 20 year strategy, that's a very, very smart strategy. And in the meantime, start putting, you know, tax incentives and all kinds of, you know, subsidies and bonuses and things for people moving from electricity and oil and coal to heat their homes and their businesses and to generate electricity to moving to solar panels and wind, because there's plenty of wind up on the ridge lines all across West Virginia, and there's plenty of solar down in the valleys, at least in the valleys that have south-facing sides. And so, you know, why not create a West Virginia permanent fund? Everybody has a guaranteed minimum income. It simplifies dramatically your anti-poverty programs because you have fewer people in poverty. In fact, why don't we do this all across the United States? In any state that has an extractive industry, which is pretty much every state these days because of fracking. Say, you know, some of that stuff you're taking out of the ground belongs to we, the people of this state. Not just the individual family who's, you know, who held the mineral rights for the land underneath them. Now, I realize this is kind of an Hugo Chavez solution, and a lot of people get very upset about it, but I think it's a start. And it would raise the price of coal to the point where alternatives to coal would start becoming inexpensive. And hopefully Pennsylvania and Ohio and Tennessee and, you know, the other states in quote, coal country, you know, around West Virginia would all start doing the same thing. So it wouldn't disadvantage one state against the others. In fact, maybe they could do it regionally, the way that up in northern New England they're doing this regional CO2 pact, you know, where when you get five contiguous states that all say we're going to put a cap on, on CO2 emissions, this is what it's going to be. This could be a really cool thing. In the similar spirit, look at what's happening in Colorado. This isn't about energy. This is about women and birth control. Colorado's teen birth rate has dropped 40% in the last 5 years. Their teen abortion rate has dropped 35%. Why are there fewer babies, fewer unwanted pregnancies, and fewer abortions? Is it because Hobby Lobby doesn't pay for birth control? No, it's because a nonprofit group came in, dropped enough money to pay for 30,000 low-income women, particularly girls 15 to 19 years old, gave them basically free birth control, typically IUDs. And the teen pregnancy rate has dropped by 40%. Mind-boggling.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's the exact opposite of Hobby Lobby, but it's sort of like the West Virginia coal thing. It's like, what's in the public interest? What do we do that's best for everybody? We are the Commons. Welcome back. Rich, watching Free Speech TV in Lemoore, California. Hey, Rich, thanks for watching DirecTV. What's up?
How you doing, Tom? I tell you, you're one of my heroes, man. You really are. You know, I most of the time I'll agree with you. Sometimes I don't, but you're still one of my heroes, man. Well, I just want you to know that.
Thank you, Rich.
But as it relates to these wages and this immigration thing, I'd like to touch on another area of that. Do you remember back in the late 70s and the early 80s when they had all these different financial programs? And how they would beat up on the blue collar workers on how their wages were too high and it wasn't good for the consumers. And that was just before Reagan really started unrolling his programs.
Right. It really started in
beat up on them.
That kind of rhetoric really started in 78 because Maggie Thatcher did that, used that rationale to break the coal miners union, which was the strongest union in the UK. And she crushed that union in 78 when she became prime minister. And that was the model that Reagan followed by crushing Patco as one of his first acts as president. Patco, which had cut a deal with his campaign that they would support him. They actually explicitly encouraged their members to go out and, you know, vote for Reagan and lobby other to tell other unionized voters to vote for Reagan. And he broke the deal with them and fired them all. But yeah, that started really in 78, that kind of rhetoric. And it was because, you know, Maggie Thatcher had legitimized basically Milton Friedman Chicago School economics.
Right, right. And if you remember, they would pick on certain industries, i.e. automobile and meat packers, because I grew up around meat packers. And you're right, they were making $30, $40 an hour.
Yeah, in today's money. Yep.
Right, even
maybe back then in that money.
Families. Yeah, yeah. So you remember when they had these financial programs, You know who they are from that era when they started putting these commentators and economists were on. And they were always saying that, well, you know, America needs to get its price of wage down so we can be more competitive and it will be better for the consumer.
Yep.
And with these high wages, that it was really hurting the economy. And I think when Reagan, when he first, because I'm here in California, as you know, when he was here in California, that goes back to one of the things he did when he was here in governor. You know, he never was really pro-union, but I think like in the South where they did have unions in the textile, he would always visit these plants demonstrating how with these wages they were making, how they were helping the economy.
Right.
While at the same time, he was talking down unions.
Yep.
That, you know, the price of goods and services were too high for the average American.
Well, he also went after the pay of people in the University of California system.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I'm just wondering, you know, could that be the seeds that were planted? So you like now we have a lot of cheap labor, carpenters don't make as much if they can find work.
This what you're identifying, Rich, is the philosophical beginning point of supply side economics. Everybody used to agree that the economy did well because people bought things, that economies were driven by demand, and that the main driver of demand was wages. So people had good wages, they created demand, and demand drove the economy. Reagan started suggesting, and actually during the last 2 years of the Carter administration, a lot of voices in the media, in particular the op-eds, the William F. Buckleys of the day, started suggesting, no, it's not wages that drive demand, it's supply. And that's because of our new technology. If we come up with cool stuff, people will buy it. The iPhone was the example. Not then, but now. It's amazing. 9 ways tobacco companies make cigarettes more addictive, more attractive to kids, and more deadly. Do you know they add chemicals to cigarettes that are bronchodilators? They open up the lungs so that the tobacco smoke passes more easily into it. They're controlling and regulating the amount of nicotine to ensure addiction. The flavorings, of course, that makes sense. Ammonia. This is freebasing. They started doing this. I remember when they started doing this because back in 72, we started the Woodley Herbal Company. We were selling herbal teas and herbal potpourris, and I was talking to people in the herbal tea, in the extract business, because our potpourris, we were buying these the herbal, you know, like extract of what's the purple flower? Anyway, it's not lilac. It's no. Anyway, there, you know, we were buying, you know, extract of rose and extract, and they sold these extracts to the tobacco companies. And we had at one point come out with a smoking mixture for people who wanted to quit smoking. It was a bunch of herbs, and or for people to cut their pot with, for that matter. And I had like a collection of these extracts that these companies that sold it to the tobacco industry had sent to me, little tiny, you know, little 1 ounce bottles. And one of them was ammonia, and I was like, "What do you do with ammonia?" And they're like, "Well, we're discovering that if we add ammonia to tobacco, it alkalizes the nicotine and turns it from an acid to a base. And the body is slightly acidic. And so when alkaline things hit the bloodstream, they bind to the blood really fast and they get to the brain really fast. If you do this with cocaine, cocaine is slightly acidic normally. And if you add an alkalizing agent to cocaine so that it becomes the, you know, it raises the pH, When you smoke that cocaine, or even snort it or eat it, it hits the brain so much harder and so much faster. It's called freebasing. And the reason why it's called freebasing is because base is in chemistry another way of describing alkali. You have acids and base. Right? And ammonia freebases tobacco. So you're free, if you're smoking cigarettes, you're freebasing nicotine. They add levulinic acid, which softens the harsh taste of nicotine. Sugars and acetaldehyde make the tobacco smoke easier to inhale. Ventilated filters. This is interesting. The ventilation holes in the filters cause smokers to inhale more vigorously, yet to pull harder on the cigarette, which draws the carcinogens more deeply into the lungs. The bronchodilators, though, that's something I did not realize. They're actually putting drugs in these things that are, it's like, you know, it's like you're sucking on an inhaler. It's amazing. It, you know, 450,000 people a year in the United States die from this stuff. And we're sitting around going, "Oh my God, Hobby Lobby is going to, you know, women are having abortions." If the Right to Life movement it really cared about life in America, they would be talking about, what about all the babies who need homes, who are already here? What about all the children in poverty? What about 500,000 people a year dying from nicotine or from cigarettes? What about 500,000 people a year dying from alcohol? I mean, these are our legal drugs. And somebody needs to take a look at what's going on in Colorado, where this nonprofit organization came in. I don't see the name of it. Colorado's also saving money thanks to the drop in teen pregnancy. I'm looking at this article over in the Daily Kos. It was written by Laura Clausen, who does some great posts over there. The decline in births among girls, she's quoting something else. I don't have the, so I can't credit it. But she says the decline in births among girls 15 to 19 years old served by the program. In other words, they're providing contraception and IUDs to girls 15 to 19 years old. Served by the program, low income. Served by the program accounted for 3/4 of the overall decline in the Colorado teen birth rate. The rate has fallen from 37 births per 1,000 girls in 2009 to 22 births in 2013. The teen abortion rate dropped 35%, but only in those counties where they're doing this, according to the governor, John Hickenlooper. This is the exact opposite of Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby says, if you work for Hobby Lobby and your daughter wants to get birth control, tough luck. Or if you work for Hobby Lobby and you're a woman and you want to get birth control, tough luck. It's bizarre. Yeah, Louise yells out from the other room, "You're not even a person, but the corporation is. Hobby Lobby is a person." Oh, yeah, no doubt about that. Okay, back to my rant about West Virginia and why don't they do something like, you know, a guaranteed minimum income. Here's what happens when wages go up You know, if people had a guaranteed minimum income, even if they weren't working, they would be spending money, which would stimulate the economy. This is demand-side economics, as Adam Smith laid this out in 1776, and it stood until the Reagan administration. But what happens when people who are making low wages make a little bit more? Minimum wage went up in 13 states this year since January 1st. Arizona, Connecticut, Colorado, Florida, Missouri, Montana, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Washington. Okay? What happened in those 13 states? In those 13 states, when you look at the percentage of change in employment, you know, the argument against raising the minimum wage is that employers will hire fewer people, right? But it's a lie. Because what happens is when you raise the minimum wage, you're increasing demand. So there's more demand for goods, so employers are going to have to hire more people to meet that demand. And, in fact, they raised the minimum wage in Washington State, and employment went up 2.1%. They raised the minimum wage in Colorado, and employment went up 1.79%. They raised the minimum wage in Florida, and employment went up 1.56%. They raised the minimum wage in Rhode Island, and employment went up 1.28%. Now, they didn't raise the wage in Mississippi, and employment went down 0.48%. Or Kentucky, where it went down 0.28%.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But consistently, the more they raised the minimum wage, the more employment went up, not down. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And well, let's get to your calls here. And it's summer. You know, we'll kind of loosen up the rules. Alan in Leander, Texas. Hey, Alan. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Hey.
What's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you, Alan?
I'm doing good. You know, I've just barely caught some of the Hobby Lobby case. And I'm just wondering, you know, the government is forcing companies to buy something and then give it away for free. Now, if you put the contraception...
No, wait a minute. That's not true. Alan, you do not have to provide your employees with health insurance under Obamacare. If you don't, you pay a small tax, but it's really small compared to the cost of insurance. So the government is not forcing anybody to do anything.
So, but if you do that... Then, if you provide him with health insurance, contraceptive coverage has to be there, right?
According to Obamacare, but now the Supreme Court has struck that down. So that's if the employer says, I'm a corporation and my religion forbids giving women birth control, then that corporation can forbid they can buy a health insurance policy that does not provide birth control to women. Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm glad you cleared that up for me. Because I've been just embroiled in my own fight that's coming with the government and the states.
Yeah, no, this has to do with the insurance companies. All of the health insurance is provided by the health insurance companies. So, you know, it's
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Alan, thanks for the call. Lori. In Bellevue, Florida, listening over on our website at tomhartman.com. Hey, Lori, what's up?
Hey, I'm calling because an earlier caller of yours had mentioned that Justice Scalia said that for, I think it was the Freedom of Religion Act way back when, that the government can regulate charity. So the government can control the practice, but not the belief.
Correct.
And I can remember when Bush's appointees were Roberts and Alito, and constantly ad nauseum they were asked about Roe versus Wade, and both of them swore up and down that they believed in stare decisis.
Right.
And then they had the second original Citizens United. That came to court, and Scalia said, no, we can't decide this, but come back with this. And then Citizens United came back with exactly what Scalia had recommended under the John Roberts Court, who promised to, you know, basically agree with established law.
Right.
I mean, I established law that was decided that.
Right. This court has become more. This court has become more radical than any court since basically the Lochner Court. You know, back in the early part of the 19th century, 20th century.
Everything. It seems as if they're going back and they're taking every case and saying, we didn't like the outcome of this case, but this is how we can manipulate it to change the verbiage and change the outcome. If
right.
we narrow it or expand it, and it seems as...
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. And, Laurie, your phone is kind of bad. I think I'm concerned that some of our listeners may have trouble hearing you. So is there a specific point you wanted to make, or did you just make it?
The point that I wanted to make was I would like all of these people, well, specifically John Roberts and Sam Alito, to be called on their coming before the Senate and thereby the United States people.
In other words, they lied during their confirmation hearings. Yeah, they lied during their confirmation hearings. I'm with you. I mean, that was the hit that the Republicans put on Earl Warren, you know, it's who had also said, you know, he was going to just do strikes and balls. He didn't use that language, but and then, you know, in Brown v. Board of Education, you know, the heads of all the Southern conservatives exploded. But Laurie, I think you've got a good point. Dan in Dillon Beach, California. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, there's a couple things I wanted to say, but I think the most important thing I could say is I just made the move. I got an electric car, and you know what it cost me? Nothing. It cost me nothing. I did a budget of how much fuel I use, and I'm actually leasing it. The lease is like $200 a month.
Right.
I pay $2,000 down. I get $2,500 back from the government. If I want to take a long trip, like the electric car, it's about 87 miles on the charge. If I want to take a long trip, I get 12 days of free rent a car. They've basically removed all obstacles on getting an electric car. And as a matter of fact, you know, the net on my budget is like a plus $100 a month.
That's great. Now, is this the consequence of California state subsidies and policies, or is it federal stuff?
It's the state. The state gives me $2,500 back.
Yeah.
So
cool.
Basically, I made $500 on my down payment. I'm saving $100 if I take the amount of money I spend on fuel and subtract $200, I have a net gain of $100. But the thing that after listening to you, the thing that's just making my head explode is how the other side of the argument gets marginalized. I'm looking at Lindsey Graham, John McCain, who have been wrong on absolutely everything. They're on Face the Nation. They take money from defense contractors. And I think about if we listen to them, how many conflicts would we be in? We'd be in Libya. We'd be in Syria. We'd be in Russia. We'd be in so many.
We'd be in Iran. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Randy Rhodes was just amazing. She said it's the best. And as I'm watching Face the Nation, they go to the commercials. She says, never mind that. Look at the commercials. Fast forward and look at the commercials.
Yep.
The Koch brothers. You know, and they're not selling you a product. They're basically just saying, here we are. We're wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, and it's.
Well, they're selling a brand is what they're doing.
Right.
You know, it's called brand marketing.
They're laundering money, basically. They're basically saying...
Well, it's not even that sophisticated. You know, they're simply buying politicians. They're buying politicians. They're buying legislation. They're buying policy. And the Supreme Court has legalized it. The Supreme Court has legalized oligarchy in the United States, and they didn't have the authority to do that. We don't have a constitutional monarchy. The Supreme Court, according to the Constitution, does not have the authority to make law, but they have. They've created doctrine.
They're buying the media, which is the big problem, because we are not making informed decisions. And the loops, the hoops that I have to jump through to listen to you is ridiculous. I live in by San Francisco. You cannot find a progressive station in San Francisco.
Yeah, I see you're listening to the web stream from our Chicago station, WCPT.
Yeah, that's what I have to do to get, you know, and, you know, I live kind of out where you don't get a whole lot of anything, because, you know, the nearest gas station here is like 30 miles.
Yeah.
So I had to jump through a lot of hoops just to hear the other side. And so many people don't get the other side, you're being marginalized. So to me, that is the number one problem.
Yeah, and that's the bad news. The good news is that some of us have figured out ways to expand our franchise, as it were. this program, which started exclusively on commercial radio, then went to the internet, and then went to Free Speech TV. We're now on Dish and Direct, you know, all over the nation. Sirius XM has picked us up. Well, actually, we've been on Sirius XM for, you know, more than three quarters of all the time we've been on the air. So we're on satellite, you know, radio all across the country. And then we started a nonprofit version of our show. And so we've got KPFK in Los Angeles and WBAI in New York. And we've got another one we're going to be announcing in a couple of weeks. And these are the big, you know, giant FM nonprofit Pacifica stations. And we've got a whole bunch of the little ones all over the country, or smaller ones. I shouldn't say little. I mean, you know, we've got a couple in Seattle that are quite substantial and around the country. And so and now Stephanie Miller and Bill Press, they're now on Free Speech TV. And so the you know, the progressive voices are actually starting to get some real significant traction. And at the same time, on the internet, there is, you know, there are progressive websites that are becoming, you know, top news sites for the country. You know, Think Progress and Daily Kos and truthout.org and alternet.org and commondreams.org and democraticunderground.com. There's a, you know, there's a whole bunch of them. So I'm not despairing, frankly. I, you know, more and more Americans are finding not just our show. I don't mean to just wave my flag, but they're finding progressive voices. It's just, you know, in the corporate media, because Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act in 83, the corporate media has become, you know, owned by just this little tiny group of people, and it's really and truly tragic. So, you know, what
right.
is going
and when
on?
You,
there?
When you have, you know, Rush Limbaugh, whose ratings are half that of any of you, yet he just gets put on.
Well, they're twice that of any of us. But he's
yeah.
but they see the deal is that his show is owned by the same company that owns the biggest radio stations in the country, and so they put him on the biggest radio stations. I, you know, my experience has been that when we're put on big sticks, we do very well. And so, you know, there's a certain amount of, in the media, there's a certain amount of self-interest. There's a mythology that it's not the platform, it's the talent. But really, it's both. If you get good talent on a good platform, you're going to attract an audience, regardless of its ideology. And if you have if you have bad talent on a good platform, it's going to fail. And if you have good talent on a bad platform, you know, on a small station, you're not going to, you know, there's going to be a limit to the audience. But, Dan, we're getting kind of down in the weeds talking inside radio, and I'd prefer not to do that. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Jennifer, who's listening to Sirius in Charleston, West Virginia, is going to tell me that I don't know anything about West Virginia. I'm looking forward to that conversation because I want to learn more about it. We'll get into that in just a few minutes. Stick with me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And over at TomHartman.com, you can drop into our free live chat room. You can also reach us on Twitter and Facebook and all kinds of cool stuff. It's all over at Tom Hartman. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kevin in Wallace, West Virginia. Hey, Kevin, watching Free Speech TV on the Direct TV satellite system. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm sitting here watching your show, and I heard you speaking about the coal industry and creating a permanent trust fund like they did in Alaska with the oil,
right,
which I'm all in favor of. And I say take it one step further and create a permanent trust fund geared towards all the natural gas they're pulling out of the ground here in West Virginia.
Yep. I agree.
And
let's call it a carbon fund rather than just a coal fund.
Okay, I'm all for that. And what really burns me up is when they pull out, they totally trash the land.
Mm.
They tell you they're going to fix the roads and put culverts in, and it'll look better than it did when they got there. It's totally the opposite. These politicians down in Charleston, I think half of them are blue dogs. They bend over backwards to accommodate these oil and drilling companies.
Mm-hmm. So what's the solution?
That's all I got to say on the subject.
Kevin, and, you know, as a West Virginian, what do you think is the solution to that?
The solution is to put tighter restrictions to get the property owners more rights, which they have taken from us,
mm-hmm.
and absolutely given complete control of the land to these oil and gas companies to do as they please. And you have no say whatsoever as to what goes on once you sign over anything as far as letting them come on your land. And I own property over the hill from where I live, and they actually drilled around my land, and a road goes through it, and they just trashed the road, and it's never been fixed.
Hmm.
And there are wells all around my land, but I would never let them drill on mine. Not that I was ever asked.
Yeah, but now that they do slant drilling and horizontal drilling, odds are they are extracting gas from under your land without your consent.
And I'm well aware of that, and I think they are. And, you know, we were all told 10 years ago that this is going to expand our tax base, and I'm thinking to myself, the roads are horrible, just horrible, because of all the truck traffic. And when these trucks come in to frack these wells, there is anywhere from 20 to 100 of them at one time. And they'll run 2 or 3 days nonstop around the clock when they frack.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, it's devastating what they're doing to the roads and land.
Yeah.
And we're not seeing none of this tax money. I'm thinking, what are they doing with all this tax money that we have been told is going to benefit the state so much?
Is there a discussion of this in the media in West Virginia, Kevin?
Very little, because there's so few news stations and newspapers,
right,
who actually don't lean toward the Republican point of view.
Yeah. So most of your media is owned by you know, corporate folks, and they do the corporate line. And it's been consolidated to the point that the small local media is gone. Kevin, thanks for the call. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? In this case, is Hobby Lobby a person? And we dare to say, no, Scrotus is wrong. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a goat to help a returning slave in South Sudan. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And so what's going on in the world today? I see you are in the basement of the White House.
I am in the basement of the White House. And White House spokesman Josh Earnest today said that the optics of President Obama going to Texas Wednesday and Thursday to Dallas and Austin and not going to see the humanitarian crisis on the border were not worrying at all to the White House, because they were very aware of the humanitarian crisis, and senior officials from the administration have traveled to the borders, and what they have seen is troubling. They've seen the influx of undocumented immigrants. They've also seen the efforts of FEMA working with various departments to set up detention facilities, etc., and that the law requires a humanitarian way to be worked. The president is well aware of what is happening, and they do not think that that he needs to go to the border, and the president is not going to the border.
Right.
There are many calls on him to go to the border.
Has there been much fallout from, you know, over the weekend? David Gregory was talking with Jay Johnson, and, you know, wanted to focus on how many people are coming to this country. And Jay Johnson said, and that somehow it was Obama's fault. And Jay Johnson said, no, you've got a humanitarian crisis going on down there in Central America. And David Gregory behaved like he didn't even know about this.
There hasn't been fallout to David Gregory. The bigger fallout, there's been two bits of fallout over Sunday shows. One is Jay Johnson's repeated refusal to answer the question, which he was asked several times directly, as to whether the Obama administration was going to deport the children, which he did refuse to answer. Okay. The other was over Governor Rick Perry, a Republican of Texas's, absolutely bizarre, surreal interview with Martha Raddatz of ABC News.
Right, in which he came up with this conspiracy theory that Obama wanted these immigrants to come to the United States, and he was encouraging it.
Right. Actually, he was doubling down on the conspiracy theory that he launched in June on Fox News. And wow. She asked him if he was going to stick with it, and he did stick with it. He also said it's really bizarre, rambling interview, which she eventually cut off. She never asked him the question that I wanted her to ask, which was, if there is a government conspiracy to bring them in, why are they bringing them in? What are they right. going to do with them when they get them here?
Oh, they're just doing it to irritate conservatives.
Maybe, but I would like her to have asked him.
Yeah, I agree.
She didn't.
Yeah.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals made an interesting ruling today, sided with advocates for young immigrants who argued that Arizona's policy of denying them driver's licenses, even though they had work permits under an Obama administration policy, violated their equal protection rights. These were dreamers, basically.
Wow. So this was, and they did this based on the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. This is a constitutional argument.
I would think it must.
Which means it's going to get kicked up to SCOTUS.
I would think if the state is going to appeal, and the AP story does not say that they will because it just happened today, but the Ninth Circuit agreed that they were harmed by unequal treatment by the state and blocked Arizona's policy in its ruling today.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yep.
Also today, the Obama administration unveiled a new education initiative designed to ensure that all students, regardless of their race or their family's income, have access to effective teachers. Education Secretary Arne Duncan made an appearance in the briefing room and announced the launch of the Excellent Educators for All initiative. He also joined President Obama and a group of teachers for lunch at the White House to discuss the program.
So how are they going to do this?
Well, basically what they're going to do is they're saying that systemic inequities exist that shortchange students in high poverty, high minority schools.
True.
So what they're going to do is they're going to ask states to analyze their data and consult with teachers, school administrators, and parents to create equity plans to guarantee all students have effective educators. They're going to get a letter and asking they submit their plans by April 2015, and to help districts develop and implement their plans, the administration plans to invest $43.3 million to launch a new technical assistance network. They're also going to publish educator equity profiles this fall to help states identify gaps.
So if they're not going to wealthy school districts, I'm thinking of where I grew up in Lansing, Michigan. Okemos is a fairly affluent suburb of Lansing. It used to be a separate city down the road, but now it's kind of a suburb. Or Holt, one of my brothers lives there. Very nice school system, brand new schools, top of the line, best science labs, great graduates. When you go into downtown Lansing and you've got old, broken down schools that are in largely minority areas, used to be people working in the car factories. Now there's no jobs. There's massive unemployment. Lansing doesn't have a tax base anymore. Holt and Okemos do. If you're not going to say to Holt and Okemos, you've got to give some of your tax money to Lansing, but you are going to say you've got to have your teachers tell their teachers how to do it, I don't get it. How does this work?
Well, the devil is going to be in the details, and the details are in all the materials that are coming out.
I see. Okay. Well, I'm going to be very interested in that, because it seems to me like, the way to do it is to reduce the dependence of education on the tax on property taxes, which was the original idea of the Department of Education, back in the day. I what was it, the Eisenhower administration? But it's, it hasn't worked out so well.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Lawyers for two Guantanamo Bay detainees have filed motions asking U.S. court to block officials from preventing the inmates from taking part in communal prayers during Ramadan, which is going on.
Right.
Lawyers argue that in light of the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision, the detainees' rights are protected under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
I think they're right.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, live from the basement of the White House, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity. Victoria, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure seeing you. We'll do that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the beginning of the third hour of our program today. And we have covered all kinds of stuff. States that raise their minimum wages are experiencing faster growth. Federal judge tells the Supreme Court should STFU about Hobby Lobby. Students in North Carolina and a bunch of other places, Texas. In these states where they have said you can use a gun permit for ID, you can use a gun permit for Dave for ID, but you can't use a student ID, even if it's a state university where they actually, you know, many of them check citizens. You can't use that to register to vote. And the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age from 21 down to 18, says that you can't limit a person's right to vote unreasonably. And so you've got students now suing these states for having passed these voter suppression laws. I think this is a great thing. I mentioned Obamacare's next threat, a September surprise. This could come as early as September. There is a lawsuit working its way through the federal courts, which says that the law says that the way that subsidies for Obamacare insurance subsidies are paid to the insurance companies is they are paid through the state exchanges. About half the states didn't set up exchanges, and some of them that did have, even like Oregon, didn't work all that well, so they just said, screw it, we'll go with the federal exchange. So the conservatives are arguing in court that the letter of the law has to be followed rather than the spirit of the law. The letter of the law says that the money is paid. Excuse me, sneezed. And they always come in threes, right? The letter of the law says that the subsidies for Obamacare are paid through the state exchanges, and there's a lot of states that don't have exchanges, and so now, you know, they got the Supreme Court to say that, you know, 20 some odd states can not expand Medicaid. So you've got 5.6 million people, 70% of them women, working women, people who are earning too much money to qualify for state-based Medicaid, which is for the truly poor, typically people making under $3,000 or $4,000 a year. But making too little money to qualify for Obamacare, which is supposed to kick in after this Medicaid expansion. So you got to be making, you know, 10, 12, 15,000, it depends on the state, a year before you qualify for Obamacare. And with subsidies, they're in that middle area, and there was supposed to be this Medicaid expansion to help them out, and there's nothing because of the John Roberts Court. They said, you know, under the 10th Amendment, the states can say, no, we don't want to participate. We don't want to take your money. And now this challenge, which will work its way to the Supreme Court probably by this fall, this challenge is the law says if you're going to pay a subsidy for Obamacare, and keep in mind the average new person, these 5 million people who sign up for Obamacare, some are saying 7 million, these people who sign up for Obamacare on average are paying less than $100 a month because of the subsidies. And in the states that don't have state exchanges, where they do have a state exchange, the exchange pays the insurance company, and then the federal government block grants that money to the states. They basically bill the feds for it. But in the states where they don't have a state exchange, the feds pay it directly to the insurance companies, which is arguably against the law. I mean, it's not the way the law is written. The law assumes that every state creates an exchange. Every state didn't create an exchange. Now, if you had a functional Congress, you could easily fix that law. It would literally mean changing one sentence in the law to say that the funds will be paid through the state exchange or lacking a state exchange through directly from the federal Department of Health and Human Services. But we don't have a functional Congress. We have a Congress committed to destroying the Obama legacy, to destroying the Obama presidency, so that years from now people will look back and say, yeah, that Ronnie Reagan, he had a heck of a presidency, but that Barack Obama, it sucked. Never should have put a black guy in the White House, or never should have put a Democrat in the White House, or both. We talked about, I didn't get to this. Germany just passed a minimum wage law. Germany never had a minimum wage. They never had a minimum wage because if your corporation employs more than 1,000 people in Germany, half its board of directors has to be made up of members of organized labor. Germany is about 70-80% unionized, heavily unionized. So people were typically making pretty good wages anyway, but they figured, you know, there are some people who are getting screwed. Let's pass a minimum wage. They just set it at $11.60 an hour. We can't even get to $10.10 an hour. Our minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Why? Because the Republicans are committed to America becoming a third world country. There's no other possible explanation. The NSA. 9 out of 10 of the emails that they're collecting right now and reading are from people like you and me. Well, not necessarily me. I'm assuming that they're checking me out because, you know, I'm in the media. I'm public. I do a TV show on RT, which is paid for by the Russian government, not me, but the network, and I've just been assuming, you know, from the get go. But you're not, right? And you got an email account. 9 out of 10 of the people that they're listening to, or reading, or watching, are not terrorists. Not anybody, you know, who's doing anything with any foreign government. I travel internationally. I figure that probably I make international phone calls. So, anyway, I also attended this sweat ceremony this weekend, and I wanted to just share with you a story. One of the things that I got out of this, or just kind of confirmed it for me, back many years ago. This is I'm reading a transcript that's over on our website titled "Hungry Ghosts" from 29 January 2007, is when I talked about this on this radio show, and at that time it was an experience that was about 6 or 7 years old for me. Carol Bedrosian publishes a magazine called Spirit of Change. I don't know if she still is. I'm assuming. It's been a while since I've talked to Carol and Little Bear, her husband. But anyhow, they have this thing called the Harvest Gathering. And they brought together all these elders, a guy from Africa, actually a couple of African shaman, South American shaman, Native American elders. And I was the white guy elder. And we had about 400 or 500 young people who showed up. And I'm sitting next to this guy named Frank, who died a couple of years ago, who was a Native American from a Canadian tribe that with a long name that I never did correctly learn how to pronounce. And Frank and I are just sitting there in this elder circle, waiting for the ceremony to begin, and we were each going to speak. And there's all these, you know, kids around. And a lot of them are dressed in buckskin. They're dressed up like Native Americans. And Frank leans over and he says to me, you know, why? He says, I don't get it. I don't understand why your people would want to be like my people. We've been the victims of 400 or 500 years of oppression. I mean, we're crushed. Our communities are in shambles. They're in tatters. We have terrible problem on the res with alcoholism and unemployment. Why would they want to be like us? And I turned to Frank and I said, you remember the old ways, right? You remember the language that's 10,000 years old. And he's like, yeah. You remember where the sacred directions are and the sacred plants and the names of things and how to do things. He's like, yeah. I said, imagine if they had taken all that away from you when they sent you off. Frank had gone to one of the Indian schools where they forbid them from speaking their native language. I said, what if they had taken all of that away from you? And he got this very sad expression on his face. He said, that would be a disaster. And I said, well, as a white guy, that's what they did to my people in Northern Europe. 3,000 years ago is the Celts, 2,000 years ago the Romans, 1,000 years ago the Catholics. They came through, and now I went back to Norway and I visited my grandfather's family home. And there's a stone in the backyard with runic writing on it. And it's only 1,400 years old, 1,500 years old, but the Catholics conquered Norway 700-800 years ago. Nobody knows how to read it. They don't know what it means. It's all gone. I mean, there's little pieces of it that they bleed through, you know, the Yule log and Santa Claus and Christmas trees, but by and large, it's all gone.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Frank turned to me and he said, now I understand why your people are hungry ghosts. You've lost your spirit. Yeah. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And interesting. Bruce in Richmond, Indiana, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing today, sir?
How are you? How are you today?
Good. I was kind of chuckling last week a little bit when you, not because you were hot because the air condition ran out. You actually mentioned my name on the air, and I never called. So I guess there was something wrong with the computer system with all the heat.
Or it was a different Bruce, and somehow the computer thought it was something, whatever. I don't know. Sorry about that, Bruce.
No, I just thought it was
yeah.
Funny.
It was 90. It was 94 degrees in here last Thursday because the AC went out. It was amazing. I was doing the show in a T-shirt.
I know. The old goat something T-shirt.
Yeah, goats for the old goat. It was Ellen Ratner's charity. She brought down some T-shirts a couple of months ago when she came back from South Sudan last time. And so that's what I had, and I took off my shirt and put on the T-shirt. Anyhow, what's up?
I kind of want to touch base a little bit on your West Virginia situation that you ran into about how the poor people are kind of separated from the rich. And,
And I was suggesting there should be a carbon tax, a statewide carbon tax like they do in Alaska, and roll that money over to the people. Give it back to the people so there's a guaranteed minimum income.
Well, I just wanted to give you an observation of what happened to when I lived up in Portland, Maine. Even though I live in Richmond, Indiana right now, I've been down here about 7 years. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Portland, Maine, and I spent 46 years up there. So now you're probably hearing my accent.
Yeah, I am.
What's happening up there for the past 25, 30 years is that the city, including the city council, they decided to focus on tourism, and I notice you don't talk a lot much about tourism from different states on how they, you know, try to get money coming in.
Yep.
Well, what they've done is they have actually built condos on the waterfront to attract rich people for the ocean view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they have built an ocean gate structure for cruise ships to come in. This is over the past 5 years they've done that.
Right.
And then they focused on hotels on the waterfront so that the people on the cruise ship can stay at the hotels.
Right.
And then they have bus services, free bus services to go around taking the tourists.
Right. They're investing in infrastructure to promote tourism. Are you suggesting that West Virginia should be doing that? Because I think they are to some extent. And before the superhighway went through, we were in Lewisburg, the town of Lewisburg, and there, you know, the old main road used to go right through the center of town, and there were a couple of hotels that used to be there, but they've been torn down.
Well, my point is, Tom, is that in Portland, they're in dire need of affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
So what the city council is doing is instead of building affordable housing, they're building hotels for tourists and visitors. That's my point, is that.
Oh, so they're making a mistake in doing that,
in your opinion. Yeah, because it's not really creating any jobs. It's not really helping the people in need.
Right.
And the other thing that's been going on big time in Maine is that, you know, we have a lot of islands out on the Gaskell Bay.
Right.
And we had a big fisherman's get down there. Well, now the waterfront is focused more on condominiums.
Right. So instead of producing something like fish, like you used to do, now it's very interesting. Bruce, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thanks for the call and thanks for interesting observation. Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C. And Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thoughts occur as I was listening. I was going to talk to you about Reynolds versus the United States, but these things occur to me while I was listening. This Hobby Lobby case is so twisted, and this is what comes up. I've never heard anybody really mention this, that they keep talking about, oh, because of the religious beliefs, they don't want to pay for your abortifacient contraceptives.
Right.
Well, wait a minute. They're not. The health insurance that you get for them, you get because you work for them.
Right. It's part of your compensation.
They're taking part of your money and holding it back and buying a group plan.
Right.
So this is what happened in the oral briefs Justice Sotomayor asked the Hobby Lobby lawyer, well, why don't you just not offer health insurance and just pay the tax if you don't want to comply with the Obamacare regulations? And the answer to that was, well, our religious beliefs say that we should offer health insurance. And besides, we want to become a competitive employer, which is what Alito cited in this. So here's what happens. Okay, so it's your religious belief that you want to offer health insurance and also comply with the law, and you want to be a competitive employer up to a point.
Right.
You know, you don't want to be competitive when it comes to, oh, we have to offer these, we're not really paying for them, it's your compensation. But then look what happens. So now you work for Hobby Lobby, and you have to take what they give you, and guess what else? You can't just say, oh, the heck with them, I'm going to go on the exchange and buy my own. You can't, because you're not eligible.
Mm-hmm.
You're not eligible for Obamacare because you already get health insurance through your employer.
Right. Right.
The health insurance your employer chose for you.
So suck it up, you know, pay that, you know, 30, 50, 70, whatever it is a month, or $500 for, you know, to have the IUD installed. Just pay it yourself. Tough luck.
Yeah, pay it yourself, even though you have insurance.
Right.
And the whole thing comes.
I got a question for you, Paul. You're a student of the Supreme Court and the Constitution.
Yeah.
If the religious freedom, if I'm reading the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 correctly, this law, which says, it's very short, actually, government shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability, number one. Number two, government may substantially burden a person's exercise of religion only if it demonstrates the application of the burden to the person is in furtherance of a compelling government interest and is the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling interest. And then under judicial relief, this is where they're basically regulating the Supreme Court, as Article 3 provides. They say a person whose religious exercise has been burdened in violation of this section may assert that violation as a claim or defense in a judicial proceeding and obtain appropriate relief against the government. Standing to assert a claim or defense under the section shall be governed by the general rules of standing under Article 3 of the Constitution. So in the Hobby Lobby case, Alito cited this law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, saying we have to rule very narrowly as a consequence of this law, and this is why we're ruling the way we are, just about birth control rather than more generally about, you know, whether men can wear beards or, you know, whatever, and therefore don't take anything more out of this. But isn't this law? Shane's got this theory that I'm still trying to wrap my head around. That this law, in a way, and in the Hobby Lobby case, in a way, was sort of the opposite of Marbury versus Madison. Marbury versus Madison was striking down a law that regulated the judiciary. It was the Judiciary Act of 1798.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court said, you can't regulate the judiciary. You can't regulate us.
Right. Yeah.
Although, you know, Article 3, Section 2 says explicitly that Congress can. But in this case, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is regulating the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court just ruled, hey, we have to rule this way because we're subject to regulation. All right, didn't they just reverse Marbury?
Well, yeah, I was kind of making that point last week, that it's so tangled up. Yeah, I mean, that is, in a sense, they're just, it's
so if they just reverse Marbury, can we now go after judicial review?
Well, yeah, and I'll go back to what I was calling about initially was, Reynolds versus the United States. That was the one that challenged the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, Justin Morrill, M-O-R-R-I-L-L,
right,
of 1862, that President Lincoln signed. Justin Morrill also wrote the Land-Grant College Act. But in 1862, they passed the Moral Anti-Bigamy Act, and it was targeting the Mormon Church, because the Mormon Church was amassing mountains of cash and claiming, oh, we're all married, we're all one big happy family, and they weren't paying any taxes. They were abusing the law that protects churches from taxation by amassing giant amounts of cash. So
and amassing giant families with one man and 10, 12, 15 wives.
Right, and then well, you have to read about it, but it's a little convoluted. But yeah, that was it. So is that one open now for review?
Right.
Is this an undue burden?
Right. Should Reynolds be revisited?
Yeah. Well, why not? Because next year they're going to hear marriage equality. You know, they're going to hear that by next June.
Sure.
I'm really afraid the way these guys rule, that they don't make a lick of sense. It's all very personal and all very political. I mean, that's what judicial activism is. And this court, Samuel Alito, is about as activist as I've in this Hobby Lobby case as I've heard of.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, in the Union case, what was the name of the Union case? Harris v. Quinn. In that case, here's what Alito said from the bench. Oh, we don't have time for it. Okay, I'll play the clip after we get back. But Paul, thanks for the call. Great to hear. I absolutely agree with you. These guys have gone off the rail. They have gone off the rail. We are supposed to have what the founders envisioned and what the people believe we have. What they teach us in civics class is that we have a constitutionally limited, representative, democratic, we vote for the majority, republic, right? But instead, we have a constitutional monarchy, and the monarchs are the Supreme Court.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what those monarchs have done, especially since 76 with the Buckley ruling, is they've said, now we're also an oligarchy. The oligarchs get to own the politicians. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. During the break, Shane says you can name me. He says, what's the sweat? I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm sorry. I'm taking it for granted that people know what I'm talking about. There is a Native American ceremony. It's common to many of the Native American tribes, not all, particularly the Plains Indians and the Native Americans of the Northeast. It's also an Aboriginal ceremony in Northern Europe. The Finnish maintain this with saunas. More men in Finland show up for community saunas than go bowling, than have bowling leagues. And there's other statistics. I think perhaps more men go to a sauna every week than go to the bar, but I don't remember. It's been some years since I saw it. But there used to be, this literally dates back to ancient times. And so a sweat ceremony is, it's a sacred ritual that also heals and cleanses the body, but the goal is to heal and cleanse the spirit. Where they build they take these sticks that make this kind of rounded house on the ground. It's maybe 4 feet high and 10 or 12 feet wide across, and these curved sticks, and then you cover them with layers after layer after layer of blankets, and you build a big bonfire out in front of it and put giant, like 6-8 foot or inch across stones in the fire. Underneath the fire, and you burn that fire for hours and hours and hours until the stones are literally red hot. And then you pack a bunch of guys into typically they segregate them, one for men and one for women. First you start out by, ritual prayers and things. And I'm sure I'm not even beginning to do justice to, I mean, this would be like, you know, like my trying to describe, rapping, tefillin, and davening, and, any Orthodox Jew would ridicule. But in any case, I'm doing my best here. There's a prayer ceremony before, and there's usually a goal for this. In this case, there were seven young men. Actually, it was a young woman too. Seven young people up on the mountains who were staying up there for 4 days on this vision quest, and this was in support of them. And you go into this sweat lodge, it's called, and they, with a pitchfork, take seven red-hot stones out of the fire and put them into a little fire area, middle area, inside the sweat lodge. Red-hot stones. I mean, it's really hot. And then they put sage and cedar on it, sometimes tobacco, and say blessings for it. And then they close the door and pour water on the stones. And it's totally black, totally dark, and it is hotter than anything you can imagine. And you're just pouring sweat. And then they say prayers and sing songs, and in some cases there are, I've been in Native American sweats with Native Americans where I was the only white person there, where it was more of a community thing. People would go around the circle and talk about how they had hurt each other or make apologies or talk about blessing each other or, in any case, I don't want to get into too much detail about it. I don't know that much detail about it, and I don't want to profane something sacred. So, and then, after everybody just kind of hits the limits of their endurance, they open the door and some cold air comes in, and there's a whole other little prayer ceremony, and then another hot rock gets tossed in, and they close the door and put more water on it and do it again. And you can do, a lot of stones over a long period of time or just a few. And so anyhow, that's a sweat lodge ceremony. So that's what was going on in West Virginia. That and this vision quest, these young people up in the mountain. And this particular one was done in a Lakota-style tradition. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about immigration. I think it's really interesting that a lot of the people that are really virulently, against any kind of immigration, besides being somewhat racist, it's so easy to pick on, these people. I mean, don't they see their humanity? I mean, a lot of them are very poor. They don't speak the language. Once they get here, they're really, taken advantage of many times by people who are bilingual that do understand the language. They're used in construction crews, and their future is really kind of bleak, and yet they still come here because where they came from was so horrible, and we're partly responsible for that.
Yes.
Our foreign policy is one of, not democracy, not in the least.
Yeah, and our trade policies and our agricultural practices and policies. John, are you familiar with the phrase divide and conquer?
I am familiar with that. The British were really good at that. We're also, into it, too. Any empire, really loves that.
Yeah, well, that's what they're doing to us. That is what the oligarchs who run this country, the wealthy.
Sure, yeah. They sit back. They have their own camaraderie. They allow, things of each other that they would never allow from us, and they present us with this hard-nosed, this is what you have to do, and you have to basically, step on your brother to get.
Yep. Well, they strip people of their dignity. They strip them of their wealth. I mean, you've got a young people, $1 trillion in debt. You've got homeowners upside down and in debt. They strip people of their wealth. They strip them of their dignity. They strip, working men of what they perceive to be their manhood, their ability to provide for their family. And then they say, oh, look it, there's some brown people over there. It must be their fault. And the crowd shows up screaming and banging on the bus.
And the irony is, too, that, when they go to that border, I lived in New Mexico for almost 20 years. That was part of Mexico. Santa Fe, New Mexico was a provincial capital of Mexico.
Right, before James Polk came along, yeah.
You know, and people had their own way of life, and they developed the, you know, speaking of, they developed the infrastructure. They lost a lot. They, land grantors are still trying to get, you know, part of their ancestral lands that were given to them by the King of Spain in places around Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and northern New Mexico. You know, and it's, you know, it's just really interesting. I mean, you know, they are, Mexicans are part of our country. They're part of North America.
Well, not only that, they're the Aboriginal people, the indigenous people. I mean, they were here before white people from Europe came, or anybody else from anywhere else. I mean, they've been here 20. The best guess is 22,000 years.
There's always an inherent racist quality when, or racist policy, I guess, when it comes to immigration, because my own forebears on my mother's side who are Italian, you know, I don't want to say it, but WOP.
Yeah.
You know,
no, there were slurs when the Italians first came over. They,
I guess I did just say it, but
yeah. But there's a great book called When the Irish Became White that talks about the Irish migration and, you know, the Great Potato Famine of 1848. And then over the next two decades, over the next generation and a half, there's this massive, Irish, immigration into the United States. And many of them came as indentured servants, and all of them were horribly discriminated against. And then eventually they were able to assimilate because their skin was white. And this book about when the Irish became white is a brilliant analysis of that situation.
Well, yeah, and, you know, they had a little bit of an advantage in that even though they, you know, they spoke English with a thick accent, they still spoke English,
right,
apart from Gaelic. But Italians did not have that advantage.
Right.
And I can tell you, it was pretty, pretty nasty, you know, living in some of those places in New York City and Lower Manhattan.
Oh, yeah, did you see the DiCaprio movie about that?
Beg your pardon?
You see the Gangs of New York, the movie that Leonardo DiCaprio starred in about that very issue?
I never did see that movie. No, I didn't. But I can tell you, you know, from my, you know, what my people in my own family have told me, you know, working in sweatshops, you know, just what their life was like living in, you know, I mean, they have now in Lower Manhattan, they have a museum of a tenement. And I'm talking, you know, cold water flat with, you know, one bathroom for the entire building.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, you know, astounding.
But here's the thing, John, because your ancestors' skin was white, or at least close to it, you know, lighter. You now enjoy white privilege. The people who, at the same time that your ancestors were being oppressed, their ancestors were being oppressed as slaves or even as free black people in the North. Because, you know, they're still conspicuous. You can still identify them by looking at them. That's not true of you. And this is the, you know, one of the great challenges of our time.
It is still a big challenge, and I work with a lot of people from Africa, and you know that they, you know, they struggle, they have to try harder, they have to do a lot better, they really struggle with living in two cultures. They're from places that, like Somalia, there's a lot of Somalis here, and I work with a lot of them, you know, that are doing the same job that I am doing, and they're wonderful people, but yet, it's a struggle. It is a struggle, and people need to really look at themselves and look at how hard-hearted they're being when they attack, you know, that person below you.
Right. Especially the children. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. John, thank you for the call. Thank you for the very thoughtful and insightful call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can drop into our live chat room over at TomHartman.com and say hi to some of the finest minds on earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Nelson in Remmer, Tennessee. Hey, Nelson, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Tom. I was reading on a blog called Katie Bar the Door, C-A-D-Y, and they cover SEC enforcement actions. And what I've been reading is the SEC versus Congress.
Yeah, this is the Securities and Exchange Commission. And what they're looking at is that there was a young man. Here it is, right here. There was a young man who worked for the U.S. House and Ways and Means Committee, which is chaired by Dave Camp, the Republican from wherever, Michigan? Okay. And this young fellow who worked for them was a guy by the name of Brian Sutter. And according to Greenberg Traurig, which is a lobbying firm, apparently according to them, this young man, Mr. Sutter, told them that Congress was going to pass this law, and so the lobbyist then told an analyst at Height Securities that the law was going to get passed, and so the Height Securities published a report on the internet saying that this law is going to get passed, and as a consequence of this, there's going to be a real big boost for the health insurance companies, and Humana's stock rose 7% according to the SEC. So they're saying this is trading on insider information and it's against the law. And the House Ways and Means Committee, Dave Camp and friends, the Republicans on the committee, are saying we are immune, we and our employees, because sovereign immunity extends to the legislative branch. Did I summarize that correctly?
Yes. And the stock prices rose an hour before the news was officially released.
Yes. Yeah, the stock went up before the news was officially released, but it was released by this one, insider newsletter, basically. And everybody who subscribed to that newsletter ran out and bought the stock, which drove the price of the stock up even before the news hit the streets. And that's why the SEC knows that something was wrong.
That's right.
So now, I forget whether it's Shane or Danielle. I think Danielle brought this to me, and she said, Lois Lerner has to testify, but Mr. Sutter, Brian Sutter, does not have to testify. I think the difference is that Lois Lerner worked for the IRS. She was merely a government employee. But Sutter actually is just a government employee. He's just working for he's on the staff of the House Ways and Means Committee. My understanding of sovereign immunity is that Dave Camp could not be subpoenaed unless there was evidence. Well, even he could probably be subpoenaed if there was evidence he'd committed a crime. But certainly his employees can be subpoenaed, but they're pushing back. They're saying, sorry, separations of power. The executive branch, which runs the Securities and Exchange Commission, the president, does not have the power to investigate Congress.
Well, it's going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And, keep your eye on this space, because There's so much going on in Congress right now that's very, very questionable. A lot of the stuff that Darrell Issa has been doing, Dave Camp at Ways and Means, and, trying to protect this guy who was apparently sharing insider information. We had on this program, Nelson, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We had on this program a number of years ago, Brian, getting Brian's last name, he was a congressman from Washington State. And on this program, he outed Tom DeLay and other Republicans who were day trading inside their offices. And he tried to make that illegal, and he finally gave up and left Congress. Welcome back, John Hartman, here with you. John in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, John, what's up? John, listening to iHeartRadio?
Are you there?
I hear you just fine. Okay. What's up?
You caught me by surprise there. About this pending court case on the states having the exchanges,
right? The challenge to Obamacare that's going to hit the courts this fall.
Well, now, isn't this a court created Boolean loop that we're in here? Because the law was predicated on the states establishing the
law assumed that the states establish exchanges, and it may be that the law required it, and that was blown up along with the Medicaid expansion being blown up by the Supreme Court. I don't honestly know.
The Supreme Court is, if this goes, it's at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has been going to be ruling on law that they made.
You're right. If the Supreme Court said that states don't have to establish exchanges, and I believe that that was the case, along with states don't have to expand Medicaid. If the Supreme Court ruled that, now, the law says that the Obamacare subsidies have to be paid through the state exchanges, and the Supreme Court gave the states the ability not to have exchanges. Now will they give the states, now will they forbid the federal government from providing subsidies to people in those states that don't have exchanges? And I think it's very possible.
They're ruling on language that was in the original law before they changed it.
Correct. Correct.
So, I mean, this is...
This just shows how partisan this court is. And what's interesting about this is, let's say that they do this, then two possible outcomes come from this. One is you end up with a situation like we have with Medicaid expansion right now, where you've got 20-some-odd states, and in those states, more than about 6 million people, 5.7 million people, 70% of them women, working women, working people who are working at very, very low wages or part-time jobs, are not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid and not making enough to qualify for Obamacare and its subsidies, and so they have basically no health insurance whatsoever. That's going on in all these red states, these 25 or so red states. Those states, plus a couple of even blue states like Oregon that did a state exchange and then said, you know, the federal one works better, we're just going to abandon ours, they will no longer get subsidies. So people in those states are going to have to get health insurance through these private companies, but they're going to have to pay the full load, the full truck, you know, the full price. And so only the states with exchanges, which are also by and large the states that have expanded Medicaid, only those states are going to have full comprehensive health insurance for everybody in their state. And every other state is not. And I'm looking at kind of a Mason-Dixon divide here. I mean, you know, the red state versus the blue state. You know, one America, a 21st century America versus a 19th century America. And the question is, what is the consequence of that going to be? Is it going to be another civil war? I don't mean literally, you know, people shooting at each other, but, a cultural civil war. I see that emerging right now. And
well, has there been a precedent for this where the court ends up ruling on law that they have made?
That's a good question. Paul in Woodinville would know. Maybe he can call and tell us. Certainly. There's all kinds of precedent for it. In fact, the court ruling on law that they didn't even make, but they said that they made. For example, in 1886 in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the court ruled in the ruling that they weren't going to take up the issue of whether corporations were protected by the 14th Amendment and therefore persons under the law with rights to equal protection benefits. But in the head note, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, who was the clerk of the court at that time, former railroad president, and this was a lawsuit from the railroads, he wrote in the head note that the Chief Justice, Morrison Remick Waite, in 1886, and Waite died the next year from heart failure, so he never even read the head note. The head note was published, you know, it took about 2 years for these Supreme Court proceedings to get published. He wrote in the head note that Waite had said, we all agree corporations are persons. That's not in dispute here. When in fact that's what Waite said, but he was talking about artificial persons. He wasn't trying to blur the lines at all. And in fact, I found the documents in the National Archives where Davis wrote a letter to Waite saying, did you really say corporations are persons? And Waite wrote a letter back to Davis saying, yes, I did, but it has nothing to do with this case. And I was talking about them as artificial persons, not natural persons. And we reproduced the actual handwritten notes in my book on equal protection, which you can see online for free over at truthout.org, or you can buy it in bookstores near you. But the point is that at least 37 times since that non-ruling, the Supreme Court has cited the head note in that case instead of the actual decision to say corporations are persons. One of the more famous ones was in First National Bank versus Bilotti in 1977, when the court extended the idea that money is somehow protected as speech under the First Amendment, which they'd ruled a year earlier. This was mostly Lewis Powell's doing. Nixon had put him on the Supreme Court in 73. In 76, in Buckley, he ruled that money was protected by the First Amendment. In 77, in First National Bank, he ruled that the First National Bank of Boston, as a corporation, had free speech rights under the Constitution. And the dissent was written by Rehnquist. And Rehnquist, the conservative, right, the Chief Justice, and in his dissent, Rehnquist says, back in 1886, without benefit of debate or discussion in public, this court ruled that corporations have standing as persons under the 14th Amendment, and I believe that that was wrong. Well, it never happened. But the court has been, you know, and Citizens United was the most recent example. The court has been ruling on law that they made. They created the doctrine that corporations are persons in 1886, arguably. And they created the doctrine that money is protected by the First Amendment in 1976. And they've been making rulings on that ever since. So, yeah, I think there's plenty of precedent for it, John. Thanks for the call. But the irony is not lost on me. And I doubt the irony is lost on any of our viewers. Thanks so much for joining us today, for being with us throughout this day. My apologies to Morris, David, Zach, Terry, Kathy, Dean, and the others of you who are sitting on hold. We'll pick up your calls tomorrow. We got a long summer. We'll have a lot of time for a lot of conversations. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to participate. Show up. Join something. Occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.